We were just enjoying that remark a few moments ago about the word class, something having real class, as a nice example of an old-fashioned, corny, passé word. And somebody else popped up and said, well, isn't it just like classification, equally passé? Well, as an entree to the whole problem of the museologist or the curators, might it not be useful to point out that the museum, as a retrieval system for classified objects, is not going to be acceptable very long? People now feel the need to have a sense of the total surround of these objects and the total environment that produced them and the sort of culture that produced them. And they like to see them in their setting, in the sort of form in which they originally existed, and, as it were, in action. Do you find a tendency move of that sort developing, Harley?
Well, I think that to do that, however, we need the help of a great number of things. We need the help of sound. We need the help of film in order to place these objects in their context, because I don't think that the old business of creating an environment, that is, putting the proper chairs in the proper room.
Just a setting.
It's just a setting. This won't work.
That's merely pictorial.
Yeah. I would even suggest, of course, that we move into the whole area of sound and light with simultaneous projections, both film and stills, and possibly multi-tape recorders to give an immediate sense or apprehension of this.
I suppose the advantage of film is that it is the ideal way of showing a process of development in any field.
Surely.
Because the very nature of the sequence of shots in a film is naturally geared to show development, and in any form, in a biological form, in artistic forms.
But when you couple this, of course, to multi-projections, you add a whole new dimension to it, so that it is an immediate apprehension, a very short-form apprehension, rather than the linear and sequential development which might occur in a film.
The multi-screen approach, does that tends to sort of telescope the developmental into a single instant.
That's right. It's a mosaic, an immediate mosaic. Now, I think that apropos of this business of creating the environment, it's very necessary to take into consideration one other thing, and that is that museums for a long time have been object-oriented. You can talk to any curator in any museum, and what his whole interest is on the object. There is very few cases in which they have been the slightest bit interested in the audience.
There's nothing wrong with being interested in the object. However, in historical regard, every kind of object tends to create a new environment. If it's moccasins or skis or snowshoes or canoes or railways or motor cars, no matter what the object is historically, it creates for itself a new environment. It enables people to enter into totally new relationships to space.
Yes, but this is dependent upon getting the objects out of those glass cases, which allow people to stand back and look at. You know, this is...
Oh, yeah, but all I'm suggesting is that there's nothing wrong with being obsessed by the importance of the artifact or the object.
No.
Provided one is aware of what it does to environments.
That's right. What it does to audience also.
Oh, well, the effect, again, the effect on the audience is an environmental one. The audience is, after all, the environment that the artifact in the museum has to cope with. An audience is the surround. It is the new environment for the artifact.
Yes, but this environment constantly changes, you see, as the audience changes. As the audience is changing so rapidly, we can no longer put up with the old methods of presentation. We have to become aware of our audience, and this is why we have to become involved in the whole area of testing audiences.
Do you remember that theme we've been working on concerning tactility, the discovery we made that touch does not create a connection, but an interval? And surely this is very relevant to the museum world, where a great passion on the part of the audience is the desire to touch the artifact.
Surely.
You remember the scandal that the sculptors of Moore created when they went to Germany and the audience was told not to lay a hand on them? The idea that sculptures should not be touched seemed an utter heresy to the Germans.
I encountered one in the in the Royal Ontario Museum, where there was a fossil tree which was probably in the nature of 500 million years old, and it was on display. And there was a small boy standing there running his fingers over it, and the guard came along and said, "Don't touch." It had been around for 500 million years. They wouldn't let him touch it.
Well, that theme of touch, which is so basic now with the new TV generation, they, having been x-rayed by the TV image for from a child, early childhood, now feel the need of handling all things in depth. The old pictorial, external look at things will not serve. But another peculiarity, then, about touch, granted that there is a natural human desire to touch things, the fact that it creates an interval involves the audience very much more. The interval has to be closed.
Mm-hmm.
When you create an interval, you have to close it, and it is the closing of the interval that creates participation and rhythm.
I don't know if you read that article by John McHale, called The Plastic Parthenon.
No.
In which he pointed out that, you know, in our age of technology, it is quite easy to reproduce things. So if you have material which is not expendable in a historic sense, there's no reason at all why it cannot be reproduced so accurately to provide an expendable item which can be handled and can be touched.
Mm-hmm.
But museums haven't entered that field either yet.
Mm-hmm. But the importance of touch we now can perceive, though, is not to establish connections, but participation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interval for participation. And this kind of relation is surely one that the museums, having grown up in the 19th century, which is so pictorial, so visual and detached a period, they have never really come to terms with this human need for involvement and participation.
Of course, it's pertinent that line we've used before, that to the blind, all things are sudden. Raising into conscious thought, yeah, the visual man, nothing is sudden. But it is that interval in the world of the blind which is highly involved.
It's the world of the breakthrough.
Yeah.
That, the suddenness of insight or of suddenness of discovery, the moment of truth, is closely related to touch and the interval created by touch.
Well, now, museums, of course, in the past have tended, museum curators tend today also to write a storyline and then use the artifacts to illustrate it. In fact, if they were writing a book, they would do exactly the same thing, except that in this case the artifacts would be photographed and used as illustrations, but there's no essential difference. In other words, they think of a museum as a book.
Well, that is one of the peculiarities, you see, and nobody needs to be told this in a way, about Expo. It is perhaps the first world fair which had no storyline whatever. It was just a mosaic of discontinuous items in which people took an immense satisfaction precisely because they weren't being told anything about the overall pattern or shape at all, but they were free to discover and to participate and involve themselves in the total overall thing. And the result was also that they never got fatigue. I remember as a youngster being familiar with a phrase which I may have invented, that museum feeling. A kind of claustrophobia and exhaustion that settles upon you as soon as you get inside those straight-lined avenues and alleyways. Once you move into a world of continuous, connected space, visual space, you quickly discover exhaustion setting in because there's no means of participation.
Well, also because the artifacts themselves don't, in many cases, don't belong in those kind of spaces. So you have a clash.
Well, they never came from... pictorial space is that of mechanical man, a highly literate man. So the native world is totally alien to it. By the way, I've been delighted to discover since I came to New York that New York is an island, and like other islands, it is characterized by a complete devotion to discontinuous, disconnected spaces, just like England. The whole of New York and perhaps other areas adjacent is dominated by the need for discontinuous space, whereas you don't have to go very far away from New York to enter a world of completely connected and continuous space, whether it's, well, Kansas City or Toronto. But New York, it's not only that the spaces of the city are discontinuous and twisted and bent into all sorts of little knobs and nodules, but the houses, the interiors. Now, this wasn't planned. I've never seen it mentioned. No one ever told me this. I've simply come here to live and discovered that the actual interiors of New York houses tend to be like this. You can't just move in a straight line right through the house. There is no such straight line. And now, this, I think, is of the utmost urgency to the museum world to know that if you want audience participation, you get rid of lineal connected spaces.
Right, but then, right today, the emphasis in the museum world is to keep on building larger and larger museums, or more and more museums, instead of putting the ones they've got in order. I know at the ROM, they're currently dedicated to building a new wing, and I quipped at one point, if we wait long enough, we're all going to have wings. But
a wing and a prayer.
Yeah. But the point of it is, I think it is very important that we should start organizing the ones we've got instead of
more of them. Surely all curators, whatever, would agree that audience participation is desirable.
No,
if it's compatible with the protection of the artifact. And you can get this participation to an amazing degree by simply arranging the spaces in which the cases are arranged.
I think one of the problems, Marshall, really is this. The curators have been trained in the lineal tradition.
Literate mode.
That's right.
Yeah.
They've all been trained in this way, and they believe that the way to teach is exactly the same way. A curator will spend months or even years trying to find one missing link in his collection.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of devoting his time to using the material he has got to say something, he will devote his time to finding that one lost shoe or some such thing.
But there'd be a wonderful opportunity there to invite the audience to supply that link, to advise them that it is a missing bit. The audience would delight in a discovery and in supplying such material. This is the charm of detective stories. You carefully pull out the links and connections between the evidence and between the story bits in order to get audience participation.
Yeah, well, one of the talking about the storyline and the using the artifacts as illustrations, I postulated the idea of creating a gallery in which there are no answers given in label form, but only questions asked.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is inherent in a proper examination of the object, up to the point of the person's understanding, at any rate.
Mm-hmm.
I think this might provide much more audience participation than...
What about, Harley, what about the O.K. Moore responsive environment treatment? You know, the typewriter that you touch the letter A and mm-hmm. it springs at you from the walls and you hear it and you feel mm-hmm. it. What about the possibility of designing for artifacts in museums also responsive environments that in which the audience could experience this participation, that when they had recognized the nature of the artifact, why the bells and buzzers would ring from all over the place, that this kind of pattern recognition, would then be paid off by the environment going into action.
Pinball machine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Large room, a pinball machine. Of course, the change in thought of education by concept, which is the old one, and today we're moving, of course, into percept.
Training of perception.
Training and perception, and I think that the whole museum world can move around into this stance.
Well, the training of perception, I suppose, really implies the training of the total sensorium, the total human response, instead of just noticing which category something fits into.
You see, I've watched people in museums over many years, and it's rather interesting, both in Europe and in America. You'll find a person will walk up to an object, look at it casually, read the label, give it a cursory glance, and walk on. They haven't really looked at anything because they are data-oriented, and they figure that now they've got the answer to that when they know it's 10th century this or that, and so they walk away from it. So the idea of setting up a gallery which just asks questions is going to force people to look at that, or touch it if possible, but at any rate, look at it. Mm-hmm. Now, in the business of creating environments for artifacts, I can give an example. In designing an Eskimo gallery, we designed it in such a way that there were no straight lines in it, or as few straight lines as we could eliminate from a rectangular room. We curved from the floor up to the walls, and we curved ceiling up down, the walls to ceilings. All were curves because, according to anthropologists, this is the quality of the landscape there.
Well, Bucky Fuller Dome might serve for such an
It would be wonderful. It would be wonderful if we could get a hold of one.
But, that is a way of tackling the artifact in its natural habitat. But it's also a habitat that it tends to make. An Eskimo world, we know this well enough from Ted Carpenter's investigations and discourse, an Eskimo world is a pre-visual world. Most of the exhibits in any museum predate the rise of visual culture with the Greeks and the Romans. Therefore, the senses that are relevant to most of the artifacts in any museum are those of what we would now call an extremely backward country, in which they use not their eyes, but their full sensorium. They would practically live in a world of ESP. When your whole sensorium is in action, you don't really use anything except ESP. The the skin of man, when it's acting as a perceptive agent, is intuitive. It doesn't need any special message. It gets the message very quickly from just the slightest change in the environmental pressure.
It seems to me we have two problems, really. One is creating. Now, first of all, it's in a museum. Therefore, you cannot create a natural environment for the object. What you can do, though, is, from the experts, get some idea of the sensory components which were most affected. What was
most
the bias?
Most dumb.
What was the bias of sense in any given culture?
Right.
But then you have the further problem of presenting that to our particular society, which has a different sensory bias. And this sensory bias varies from children to adults.
But on the other hand, we are sort of circling or cycling back to that pre-visual culture, so that much of the latest culture of our world is getting very close to the most primitive culture in terms of the sensory life. The real gripe we have about the Beats and the hippies and the teenagers and teeny boppers is that they're so primitive.
That's right.
And we're trying to force them back into a literate context and sort of down rover. And instead of looking straight at this development and saying, all right, what do we do about it? How do we use it for education? By the way, the Eskimo igloo is a nice example of an auditory space. Since the Eskimo was not a visual man, he naturally preferred an auditory space, a resonating dome-like structure. But doesn't it follow in the same way that the new preference or the new inclination toward Bucky domes indicates that we are going non-visual and auditory and tactile in our own time?
Well, but we need more data on this because you know it, I know it, and various other people know it. But to convince museum directors across this nation, we need data.
I wouldn't think it necessary to convince them so much as to alert them to the possibility of completely new relation to the public.
Well, this is true.
I think you have to convince them by argument.
No, not by argument. No, I don't want to convince them by argument, but I would suggest that the idea I put forward to have a console, for instance, in a gallery, which would allow a person to manipulate the light, high, low, warm, cool, and to choose sounds in relation to things, would be able to give us, and then there'd be a feedback on that. Now we would, then we would have some data, would be very convincing.
Yeah. See?
There's the problem in museums, of course, of the fact that Near Eastern curators don't talk to Far Eastern curators. Far Eastern curators don't talk to ethnologists. And so you get this fragmentation And they never, you very rarely ever get a chance to bring these various artifacts from different cultures together so that they can create abrasive situations alongside each other.
Interfaces.
You never get it, or very rarely, except in special exhibitions.
The researcher is a man who deliberately creates interfaces in order to make discoveries. Mm-hmm. He deliberately sets up situations that will mutually irritate one another until they suddenly get a flash inside.
Yes. But it's very rarely that... this is a matter of territoriality, actually.
Yeah.
Each man is defending his own
territory.
Well,
that's, again, the classification approach. Mm-hmm. The old 19th century classified knowledge approach, alphabetized approaches.
But, for instance, to give an example, it only recently occurred to me in getting to work on some Chinese material, a tremendous flash came to me that the Ming period, Chinese culture, which is a rather decadent period, was coincidental with the Renaissance, High Renaissance. This is a very interesting thing.
You mean that in chronological
terms? Chronological terms, yes.
Uh-huh.
But you never have any chance. The average person never has any chance to make that discovery.
Well,
because they never bring the artifacts together and say these coexisted.
Mm. Any medievalist would regard the Renaissance as decadence.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Just as we today regard the Renaissance as decadence.
We today, you feel, tend in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in other words, we tend to favor the Middle Ages again, too.
That's right.
Which is, again, a non-pictorial space. It's not a simple continuum anymore. The Renaissance discovered the merits or the advantages of a simple continuum or connected space.
Well, of course, these light shows, the electric circus, and all the rest of the things that are going on are very indicative of this whole business of the breakdown of lineality. And the youngsters love it. So I think that we have to inject these new techniques into museums to bring them alive.
I'm not sure that we need foster them so much as exploit them in the hope that they will go away quickly.
No, I don't think so. I think that there's a tremendous potential for education in this, in that particular mode, in terms of pattern recognition rather than data assimilation. You see. I think we could really provide orientation centers for museums or for specific areas so that the person doesn't walk in just off the highway or off the streets of our cities and you suddenly confront him with a 10th century Chinese vase. He doesn't know what to do with it. So you have to provide him with some kind of orientation centers. And this, I think, is where the light shows could come in as fast methods of orientating.
Oh, I think that's fascinating. I think that would be very desirable.
It was interesting. I wondered what you thought, you speak of New York City as being no continuous space.
Well, we just had a hideous experience of it on the damn freeway.
How would you tell that to the person who lived, or the people that lived in railroad flats?
Not just a moment. The railway is not an island. Its lineality is pure mechanism, the wheel.
What do you mean by railroad?
Railroad flat is a term applied to a New York apartment where every room was in a straight line.
Never heard of them.
Oh.
Never heard of them.
Well, they were like a whole era. And there's a whole
When would they have been built?
Early part of the century, weren't they?
Yes.
That makes sense.
Where you walk through every room to get to the next room.
That makes sense.
Only continuous space, nothing else but.
Well.
Now, an interesting thing, the other day I went into an agency and someone said to me, how do you know your way around here?
By the way, this is the way museums are laid out. Railroad flats. That is exactly the way they're laid out.
I went into an agency and someone says, how do you know your way around here? I said, I can tell you where the conference rooms are, where the president's office is and everything. Every agency building of, say, that was built in the last 20 years is identical.
Mm-hmm.
The elevators are in the center. There's a corridor through the middle and everything goes around.
Yeah.
The higher the executive, the more he is to the outside. All the typing pools are inside the conference rooms.
Those elevators really dictate the building, though.
Yes.
Boy, that's an amazing amount of space they take up.
And after all, they're purely lineal.
I wonder if we could just cover one more point. Is this fine?
Really?
Yeah.
Yes. I noticed you referred to film as a way of allowing you to see growth and so forth. sound does too. I mean, tape as videotape today as yet doesn't. The equipment doesn't exist. It does exist on a very
Yes, I remember some of your own tapes in that regard. Now, New York 19, though, is not a developmental. That's an all-at-once multi-screen effect. That's environmental. Mm-hmm. Whereas what you were speaking of in the remember the lifespan of the child's contracted into how many minutes? 90.
2 minutes and 4 seconds.
90 seconds or so, but. The that is developmental because of changing tone, changing this and that.
It's kind of instant history, isn't it?
But it isn't exactly the same as a storyline, though, is it? It's a it's a date line. It's a chronological line of development. But it isn't a literary storyline.
Basically, I'd say the most accurate thing there is primarily the ability to hear voice change over a period of time.
Yeah.
Subject is loosely covered. You can begin to see levels of and so forth. But voice changes.
Really when you're dealing with the total environment, as in electronic music, though, you don't get that developmental dimension, the sense of storyline or change in pattern, do you? The changes are more like light changes, total, rather than just in a single aspect or line or point of view. The New York 19 has no point of view. It's total.
Well, the story of the child, too, there is no storyline because it's a formal, it's an emphasis of formal development. It's a process, yeah.
It's very interesting you say New York 19 has no point of view because I was younger at that time. I thought, gee, I had a grant to do that. I thought I should call in some people who are knowledgeable in this area. And they all said, for research, you have to set out to prove something. And I said, I have no interest in proving anything. And they said, well, you have to make an assumption that in the process of proving, of finding out whether you're right or wrong, you find out your material. I said, I just know that this neighborhood is musical, and I just want to show it. That's all. I mean, the proof I had long before, I just said, I know it. It's a musical neighborhood, and I just want to show
it. Well, if you have, again, you have the example of the total environment is always inaudible or invisible, whereas when you transfer it to another medium, then you begin to enjoy it as an art form.
Surely, people go, it's like Ben Shahn's paintings. I remember when I was at college, I suddenly discovered Ben Shahn. Who illuminated the whole area through which I had been walking for several years, backwards and forwards to college, and suddenly all the buildings suddenly became Ben Shahn buildings, you know, with the things hanging out when they were building them and so on.
There's an article on Ben in Time this week, is it?
In Time,
last
yes.
Last week, there was an interesting one this morning. You were talking about, you know, the audience as environment and everything like that. Did you see the multimedia thing in the Times yesterday?
Actually, yes.
Yeah, here and there. Today's Times on New York Film Festival, the lady talks about the movie, the pre-McLuhan and post-McLuhan moviegoers, and she says that the real thing here is not just people sitting looking at a movie. It's what happens in the halls. It's people looking at each other, and the great comparison between the kind of in film crowd compared with the crowd that hangs out there for music or something like that. Very different. It's a very interesting piece.
That's in today's
Times. Today's Times, yeah. In the
film
entertainment section.
Wow.
Incidentally, I'll just interject a note here. Ted Carpenter told me some time ago that the igloo was created by the Primus stove.
Yeah.
Not by the Eskimo.
Couldn't read that.
No. It was the Eskimo's response to the Primus stove that made the igloo possible.
It was Western technology that made
the two, the hybridizing.
Did anyone read this book about Antarctica and how the disease that's most prominent there is this disease of disorientation that comes from losing the horizon?
But just a moment, is this true for natives or are there any natives?
Were there ever natives?
There are no natives, but I would imagine that this could be true of Eskimos in certain times of the year, because they say that the snowstorm makes the horizon blend in with the landscape.
Well, but with the Eskimos, so he's already adapted himself to that environment.
He doesn't orient himself. Sound, on the other hand, tends to acoustic space. Remember our Papa Box? Acoustic space has no peripheries and no centers. It is a total sphere without boundaries and without centers. This is the kind of space that would drive the visual man mad. Mm-hmm. But electronic music draws attention to this acoustic character of space. In electronic music, you put the whole environment into action, and there are no boundaries, no peripheries.
In what way do you mean that?
You cannot see a vanishing point or detect a boundary in electronic music. There are no boundaries.
Well, who's making the electronic music have anything to do with it?
I imagine it could have. You could introduce.
Yes.
I've heard a mass in electronic music. You could.
Mass.
You could impose other patterns, but the tendency is just to let the environment itself resonate. Without a storyline, without content.
Somewhat the way you did New York 19, as you explained it.
In New York 19, there is content. There are identifiable objects.
It's also the environment resonating.
Isn't the individual the center of sound?
Yes, I would say so.
Yeah, as center of experience of sound. Oh yeah, but not necessarily the source of sound. The experience, the input area.
And that way there are many centers, multiple centers, but no peripheries.
Each individual is
a center.
Center and has his own unique perspective in relation.
Not necessarily a perspective.
Because there aren't any peripheries.
Unique relation.
Response. Yeah.
It's like a mass of bubbles put together, really, if you take a group of people, you know.
Each one has, no two people can have the same center in sound.
Remember the PDQ Bach, section, the pervertimento for bicycles. Balloons, bicycles, and
bagpipes.
So
beautiful.
The balloons are rubbed together and screech.
You know, I think in a funny way, you might be interested in hearing I was able to do one commercial recently for RCA where I just want to say the world of sound is available on RCA, so I was able to counterpoint every type of music in 60 seconds.
That's a bloody museum.
That's right. Yeah. It is. There's a museum.
Maybe there'll be time to get this one. I was judging a film festival on the West Coast, and Dog as God Spelled Backwards, and it was a history of Western painting in 4 minutes. They must have shown 1,500 paintings in 4 minutes.
I wish you'd get it for me, because this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
At the Museum of Modern Art.
Okay. I had to make a little correction.
If it goes so fast that the sight comes from his lips and his...
Stop that. Gotta go back. Gotta make a correction here.
We were just...
It's very rarely that...
We missed a bit for recording, so I'm just going to replay these couple of minutes.
It's a matter of territoriality.
Yeah.
Each man is defending his own
territory.
That's,
again, the classification approach. Mm-hmm. The old 19th century classified knowledge approach, alphabetized approaches.
But, for instance, to give an example, it only recently occurred to me in getting to work on some Chinese material, and a tremendous flash came to me that the Ming period, Chinese culture, which is a rather decadent period, was coincidental with the Renaissance, High Renaissance. This is a very interesting thing.
You mean that in chronological terms,
yes.
Uh-huh.
But you never have any chance. The average person never has any chance to make that discovery.
Well,
because they never bring the artifacts together and say these coexisted.
Mm. Any medievalist would regard the Renaissance as decadence.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Just as we today regard the Renaissance as decadence.
We today, you feel, tend in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, in other words, we tend to favor the Middle Ages again, too.
That's right.
Which is, again, a non-pictorial space. It's not a simple continuum anymore. The Renaissance discovered the merits or the advantages of a simple continuum or connected space.
Well, of course, these light shows, the electric circus, and all the rest of the things that are going on are very indicative of this whole business of the breakdown of lineality. And the youngsters love it. So I think that we have to inject these new techniques into museums to bring them alive.
I'm not sure that we need foster them so much as exploit them in the hope that they will go away quickly.
No, I don't think so. I think that there's a tremendous potential for education in this, in that particular mode, in terms of pattern recognition rather than data assimilation. I think we could really provide orientation centers for museums or for specific areas so that the person doesn't walk in just off the highway or off the streets of our cities and you suddenly confront him with a 10th century Chinese vase. He doesn't know what to do with it. So you have to provide him with some kind of orientation centers. And this, I think, is where the light shows could come in as fast methods of orientating.
Oh, I think that's fascinating. I think that would be very desirable.
It was interesting. I wondered what you thought, you know, you speak of New York City as being no continuous space.
Well, we just had a hideous experience of it on the damn freeway.
How would you tell that to the person who lived, or the people that lived in railroad flats?
Not just a moment. The railway is not an island.
Its
lineality is pure mechanism, the wheel.
What do you mean by railroad?
A railroad flat is a term applied to a New York apartment where every room was in a straight line.
Never heard of them.
Oh.
Well, they were like a whole era. And there's a whole
When would they have been built?
Early part of the century, weren't they?
Yes.
Huh? That makes sense.
Where you walk through every room to get to the next one.
That makes
only
sense.
Only continuous space, nothing else but.
Well.
Now, an interesting thing, the other day I went into an agency and someone said to me, how do you know your way around here?
By the way, this is the way museums are laid out. Railroad flats. That is exactly the way they're laid out.
I went into an agency and someone says, how do you know your way around here? I said, I can tell you where the conference rooms are, where the president's office is and everything. Every agency building of, say, that was built in the last 20 years is identical.
Mm-hmm.
The elevators are in the center. There's a corridor through the middle and everything goes around. Yeah. The higher the executive, the more he is to the outside. All the typing pools are inside the conference rooms.
Those elevators really dictate the building, though.
Yes.
Boy, that's an amazing amount of space they take up.
And after all, they're purely lineal.
What if we could just cover one more point? Is this fine?
Surely. Yeah. Yes.